Hello, my name is Chris Snipes, and you are listening to The Melt. There is a very simple yet profound universal truth that is so utterly important to remember and practice. Nothing is permanent except change. If there is anything that we can rely on in this existence, it's knowing that things are constantly transforming. Sometimes much slower than we wish that they would, and sometimes faster than it feels like we're ready for. The trick is being all right no matter what the circumstances might be. But the real trick is seeing what we perceive as reality as it is, meaning not only without our usual filters and biases, but apprehending the concept that we all have an important participatory part to play in what we define as consensus reality. It can seem so easy to double forget, to not only forget that you possess such a power, but to forget that you forgot. It can happen in a culture that stresses the material reductionism that makes it easy to think that we're just happy accidents in a random universe. And then we mistakenly think that we are mere products of our environment as opposed to being an intrinsic part of an interconnected environment. And then we further disempower ourselves by pointing the finger at others and blaming them for our discontent. Part of waking up might be seen as a sort of awakening to all that one is fully capable of, meaning our place in Indra's net. Today's guest, Cynthia Sue Larson, is a physicist and a reality shifter. She believes that our actions in the present can affect not only the future, but also the past. She was a keynote speaker at the West Coast Mandela Effect Conference not too long ago, and I begin the conversation by asking how the conference went.
Oh my gosh, it was awesome. I just had the best time because the people there were mostly, primarily, very what you call Mandela effect affected. So I had never before in my life been in such a group of people where I could say something like I did. One of the things I was preparing for one of the talks I gave, I could not find the research to cite. It was missing. It's like it had never happened.
Out of your book, right?
Well, I think this was something that was, there was something from my book also, but there was also this experiment that they had done with these little microorganisms living in a petri dish that could only eat, a certain kinds of diet. And this researchers knew that and put, in fact, you could say these were lactose intolerant organisms. And so the researchers gave them so-called nutrient agar, because it's meant to be a feeding substrate, but they put a substrate that was made of milk, like lactose, which these organisms, they knew, could not eat. So the bacteria, well, here's what's amazing. They were able to just genetically make a huge quantum shift or quantum jump to an organism that was capable of eating that kind of lactose food-based product. Wow. Within just a generation. And that's remarkable. And I couldn't find the study. So going back to the conference, when I mentioned that to the audience, they knew exactly what I meant. There was just sort of like a friendly chuckle, like, yeah, we know what that feels like. And I was just like, wow, these guys get it. And then I asked, did anyone happen to see that study? And then sure enough, someone in the front row, like, yep, I saw it. Well, thank you. Well, I can't find it at the moment. Might come back. More laughter. You know, it just felt, the support in the community is incredible. So that's that's what's so great, is to be in a room full of people that get it. You can talk about stuff that your family and your friends are going to be shaking their heads like, and just giving you that look. but to be surrounded with intelligent, wonderfully open-minded, open-hearted people, there's nothing like it.
Yeah.
So it was the best weekend of my life, is what cool. I said at the time. And just thinking back, I just get this glow. So I loved it.
Yeah. Very cool. Were there people from all around the world, or mostly around the United States?
We had Canadians were there, and we had otherwise mostly the United States, although a couple of people had lived in Europe. And so they were bringing experiences that they'd had when they had been living in Europe, and the geography had changed, for example, that kind of thing. So it was really cool, again, to get that global feeling. And it wasn't just happening where I live in the Bay Area, in Berkeley, which some people call Berserkly. So it's not just this Berserkly phenomenon.
Yeah, sure.
But it's actually everywhere. There's no Bermuda Triangle for the Mandela effect. Totally is a global phenomenon. And we can see that. I've known that, of course, because I've collected firsthand reports from around the world for more than 20 years. And so I've been recognizing that this is not just happening in Berkeley or just in California, but really it's happening everywhere.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, could you describe, wasn't there an experiment that you maybe, I don't know whether you conducted it there, but it had something to do with dragons?
Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah. Well, that was a playful sort of an experiential exercise. So I gave two talks, and in the first one, I asked the host and the organizer of the conference, Jerry Hicks, to please assist by handing out some little folded pieces of paper. And before, so each person in the audience got one, and then they would hold it in their hands and just think about what impressions they were getting, maybe do a squiggle or if they're that kind of drawing kind of person, sketch something on that they're just perceiving or feeling, and then go ahead and open it up and see what they got. So that was the exercise there. Previously, at the breakfast before the first day of the conference, I had intuitively felt that prompted or inspired to bring these little tiny miniature little figurines. There were, I got the number 11, so I brought 11. I sort of felt inspired to bring certain things like a Pegasus, a unicorn, a panda bear, a little bumblebee, an eagle, a meerkat, a purple dragon, and then what you might call a white luck dragon. So those had been either, I felt inspired to give it to somebody in particular, or they drew it that day. There were exactly 11 people at that breakfast. It was exactly matching the intuition I got. Everybody got one. And so later that same day, everybody who'd gotten the little 11 actual plastic pieces, little toys, they also got a piece of paper. And two of the people who had received the actual purple dragon and the actual white luck dragon, coincidentally, they were handed exactly the same thing again by the organizer, Jerry Hicks. And Jerry wasn't looking at it. They're all folded. He doesn't know what he's handing out.
Wow.
So it was very meaningful for those individuals to get that. And it had deep significance because in the first place, they felt like they'd received the correct sort of spirit animal, or, you know, Jungian archetype, if you will. So that characterization that has a quality to it that for some reason matches what they're thinking about or going through or drawing energy from.
That's amazing. And again, another example of the co-collaborative nature of reality.
Yes.
What is it? I mean, it seems like a lot of the, well, I don't want to say problem, but the potential difficulty that we can run into when we're trying to, excuse me, quantum shift or quantum jump is concretizing reality, concretizing things. By how does that occur? By observing them too much, constantly wanting to check in, or?
Well, I love your question because it's even more fundamental than that. I think even some of the quantum physicists are stymied when they concretize quantum physics. So you might think, how could they do that? Well, I've seen it happen and it's easy to do. What happens is we get inculcated in a certain belief structure and assumption base that we build science upon even. And then that in itself can become a stumbling block toward actual progress in something like a theory of everything. So I actually get the best sort of conversation and dialogue going with the theoretical physicists who are working on a unified theory of everything, because they really are looking at all of it, and they're willing to scrap the assumption base and get down to what's real. And that takes real intellectual metal and mettle, you know, yes, strength. Yes. It takes a lot of courage, because it flies in the face of a lot of people who, without knowing it, they have concretized even quantum physics itself. So that's a real risk. But I think you were asking a more specific question. But when you asked it, that's where I went right away, like, wow, yes, we're steeped in this concretization of reality. We tend to think that what we see is real, even when we know that's not true. So we're so heavily biased by what our senses show us that we tend to completely miss what's going on, the whole factor of observation and the truth of what consciousness really is. We can skip over who are we, who am I, what is this, how can I call myself I, what is this doing the observing? You know, these are the big questions. And when we block it out and think, well, I'm this body, this is what I am, I know this, really? Because we've got evidence that shows something else. And so when we skip over the evidence, and just for the purpose of staying in that concrete world, that there's a huge risk that we run to kind of end up in a very oversimplified version of reality that's a little bit off. And so...
Because really, I mean, the self could be, maybe you could describe it as like an intersection that's fluidic, and it is where the circumstances that you find yourself within and your intention meet. Would that be a way of describing it? Or like, what I mean by why I described it as an intersection, because it's like a sort of a fork in the road, only there's more than two ways to go. There's several ways to go. And from there, depending on what you choose, what line of action or thought you choose, you can steer it in a completely different place, right? I mean, and that always changes.
That's a good way to look at it. A lot of people, they don't realize the level of choice they have, and they make an assumption that they are limited, that somehow they're stuck. And I would say that might feel true, but there are levels of mastery possible where people can, for example, slow down the experience of time. And meditators can do this. And anybody who's aware that they're able to get that reflexive cognition to be aware of the observer, if you know how to do that step back, or even if you practice it regularly enough, then in the moment where you really need it, it's possible to feel like you can bring so much attention to that moment that time, you will feel time slow down. You'll feel it seem to stop, and all your senses will match that perception. I've had this happen to me on a couple of occasions, and it's extraordinary. It's when you need it. So it's not something like a parlor trick, like, oh, I'll show this. And I don't think other people would see it happening anyway. It would just look like a burst of genius or a tremendous physical prowess being demonstrated inexplicably. Like, wow, that person did an amazing thing. That's funny. And not knowing like that, they needed to because of circumstance. So yes, you can definitely look at it as your awareness meeting a circumstantial event and then coming together. But then the way you do that and the choices you're aware of, they can draw from a great deal of practice that you may have as a meditator, and especially with that reflexive cognition, just awareness of being observant and awareness of being aware.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and aware of how important it is what you do in any given situation, how much attention, how much intent you bring to it.
Right.
Because it counts.
It totally counts. And I think a lot of people don't know the degree to which that is true, or that people can see it. You know, a lot of people think, well, I just showed up and I'm bumbling through, but people see that. And I once was talking to someone who'd had a great deal of acting experience, and in the conversation we were discussing how if you cross a room as an actor, if you're told, okay, walk across the room, a gifted actor will know that that was not the full directions. They won't even walk across the room. They'll say, excuse me, how do I walk across the room? In other words, and you might think that sounds silly until you realize, no, that's true. Because are you walking across the room like you're an 85-year-old man and you've been hunched over for years and you can barely move? all kind of creaky? Or are you bouncing across the room like a young kid? Are you sneaking across the room like a ninja? Mm-hmm. You know, how exactly are you doing this? Or is it the Ministry of Silly Walks from Monty Python? It could be anything. So,
yeah, that's true. Well, in order to quantum jump, or what would shift or jump? What would be the way? How do you describe it? Jump.
Well, when I use the terms, I've started talking about reality shift as mm-hmm. something that happens. Like, okay, you've noticed a shift has occurred. You've noticed the Mandela effect has occurred, mm-hmm. and it's not perhaps something you meant to have happen. It's more of a remarkable situation. Whereas, in contrast, the quantum jump would be typically something where a person desires to become more confident, more focused, more in their heart, more caring, more committed, all these different things. And gotcha. In my book, Quantum Jumps, I show simple exercises that can help people to get to those states of being that are pretty much laboratory tested, where it's remarkable. There's a proof, and people have demonstrated that without people knowing what they were doing, that it had the desired effect for this simple kind of physical action. You could say they were tricked into doing it, but they didn't know what the significance was. For example, just pointing, resting so one or several fingers are pointing to their head, and then being given some kind of cognitive task. The people that were, for some reason, doing that, and they're doing something else, so they think there's some cover story of why they're doing that. But then the effect is they do much better on the cognitive task than people that were not pointing at their head. And that's fascinating.
It is. That's very interesting. So the jump would be something that's more intentional, whereas a shift is something that just sort of you stumble into it, or it seems like you stumble into it.
Exactly. Okay. Yes. That's how I use the terms.
Okay. So when one is intentionally wanting to make a jump, you stress that purity of heart is something that's important. What do you mean by that quality?
Well, for me, the purity of heart is important because it brings more energy, and quantum jumps require energy. So it's sort of a combination of factors. That there's typically you just need to know what the desired state is. Need to bring enough sufficient energy to make that leap. And you just need to really believe it's possible. So the purity of heart, it brings the energy that could otherwise be completely blocked. When people don't have purity of heart, when they don't feel like they're fully in, something often gets in the way. I see this with people who they think that they want something because they're thinking it in their head, but their heart's not really in it. Their heart Yeah. is feeling like it's somewhere else, doesn't really care. Not really invested, doesn't matter. And so that does not bring the requisite energy to make that kind of a jump into a new state of reality or a new state of being or new state of circumstances, because that's literally what can happen when you make these quantum jumps. It can feel like you've walked into like a different world.
Yeah, and it seems like almost like an act of rebellion in the sense that it goes against really everything that we've been taught from the moment we were born, right? I mean, no science, well, lately science is now addressing this stuff and actually giving it the time of day, but you know, we have everything, tell everybody from every direction telling us that this stuff isn't possible, that it's, you know, that there is an objective reality and that maybe we can have an effect on that, maybe we can't.
Right.
So that it's kind of like you kind of have to forget all of that.
Exactly. We're told it's wishful thinking, magical thinking. Mm-hmm. But actually, that kind of wishful, magical thinking, if you've got that purity of heart and you can act as if what's desired is true and you're bringing enough energy to it, that's where we say things like, oh, that's beginner's luck. That person just got lucky. You know, we call it luck, but I think that's it's a miswording. It's misleading. And maybe it is luck, but I'm just also saying we're creating that luck by being open-minded, open-hearted, by bringing that rush of energy, really acting as if something is true, keeping totally focused on it and making that leap. So we're seeing signs of it. We do have names for it, but I think we've misnamed it.
Yeah, we've misnamed a lot of things. Misconceived too, I think. Like, we've made reality something much more linear than it actually is. Speaking of which, a facet of all this that totally just boggles my mind is trying to conceive of time in a different way. Like you have said, and it has been said by other people too, that all time exists simultaneously. I have a really hard time wrapping my mind around that. Do you have an easy way of explaining what that means?
Well, sometimes when I talk about like changing the past, retrocausality, I'll bring up the Archimedean idea of know when, you know. This is an ancient concept, so it goes back to the Greeks, and it really takes us, so I want people to know this is not some brand new mumbo jumbo. This is good, solid philosophical material. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at that idea of know when, then it's that sense that you can really feel what it's like to have no time at all, to be in that timeless state. And you get that feeling. We know what it feels like, because if you're doing a favorite activity, we joke about it, like, wow, time flew. I was talking to my best friend. We were laughing. I guess 3 or 4 hours went by. It didn't feel like it. Felt like 5 minutes, maybe. You know, we know that feeling.
Yeah,
it's when you're doing something you just love, and it's that fully immersive experience. So I think when you relate to it that way and say, okay, I think we were in that no time where we're not looking at our clocks. We're not trying to figure out how. It's not that feeling of being tortured and tormented, like, wow, when can I leave? And you keep looking at the clock and it looks like the second hand is frozen or something. Like, it's just crawling by. So time is a strange thing anyway. And our way of measuring it, we think it's linear. We think it's something that stays the same, but it really doesn't. It's completely dependent on the things that we're comparing it to. So we always have to have a basis for what do we mean by time. So when we talk about time, it's the surface of the earth time. It's not outer space time or something else. But even that surface of the earth time can be remarkably malleable. So going back to no time, it's a central concept in reality shifting and quantum jumping. Because when we feel that state of no time, we are really capable of, to me, it feels like I am in that wave function state, like I am smeared across all possibilities. Mm-hmm. When I'm in no time, when I'm in that Archimedean no win. And when you're smeared out over all possibilities, and then you get that feeling of this is where I want to be, I would hope you could trust your heart for that, but then your heart would often show you this is where you'd love to be. And it might feel scary, it might feel like a stretch. People who've been nearly dead, or actually legally dead, have been able to see that sense of all possibilities and jump into a reality where whatever they were sick with goes away. So there have been reports of this. It's a rare thing, but it does happen. And I think that also can give you that feeling.
Is time traveling a proper way of describing that? I mean, is there time traveling proper, or is it just a matter of quantum jumping?
We think of time travel and we think we just want to go as we are and go back to some time. We have a very fixed idea of it, but space and time are intrinsically interconnected. So if you're traveling through space, you're traveling through time. And you're doing time travel anytime you get altitude over the Earth's surface anyway, because time's doing something different. Mm-hmm. So we're space travelers if you fly in an airplane. But forgot your question again. What was the question exactly? This one is such a tangle.
It space is. And time. Isn't it all? Is time traveling a thing, or is it just a matter of quantum jumping? Because time traveling lends itself to the concept of you go backwards or you go forwards. But if time is not linear, then that doesn't make any sense, right?
Right. Well, I like the book, The Yoga of Time Travel by Fred Allen Wolf. He was in What the Bleep Do We Know? So he explores not so much the time machine factor, but more like the yoga of it. Like, how would you set about doing this? And it's very interesting because it does require that mental focus. I think it is technically possible to go back or forward in time if you allow yourself to recognize you're going in a daydream sort of theta brainwave state of mind. So it's a little bit like being hypnotized, or it might feel like you just went there in a daydream, but it could have real effects in your life. People that do this in order to change some sort of life-threatening disease they have, for example, can see significant improvement. They might have some impossible medical condition, but through that sense of going back in time and just feeling like they're bringing healing to their birth or to the time of conception or whatever, they might be able to reverse out. And I think it's important that your mind is feeling like if the doctor's told you you've got a genetic condition, nothing can change it. Well, maybe you can go back to when it started. That's what I'm talking about. You can actually envision like, okay, that's cleared. And to some degree, it's sort of a Dumbo's feather, but we often believe what people tell us. We believe the objective truth and facts and all that sort of thing. But if you study reality shifts and the Mandela effect and quantum jumps, then you know things are changing and anything can change. There's really no limit. So the time travel, if you open your mind up to what it can be, then it's not so much like jumping in a machine and jumping out and then changing something and then jump back in and come back to your life. Instead, it's the way I've experienced it and the way people I know have experienced it. Usually, it feels more like it's a daydream or something. There are some exceptions where people literally felt like they did go back in time. And that's interesting, too.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard any stories of, you hear it in sci-fi stories all the time, but people taking an object from another time and bringing it back?
Yes. It's happened to me. My future self came into my room and took something out of my roll top desk, which I still haven't seen so far. So, and I was just a teenager at the time. I don't know if it'll show up at some point or what happened, but it's not even necessary that it shows up in my conscious reality. It might just go somewhere else to some other possible future reality.
Yeah.
So time is not even what we think it is. There's like an infinite number of possible pasts and an infinite number of possible futures. And we're just sort of weaving and going between all these possibilities.
So it's like a trillion lane highway, and we're going in from one lane to another all the time.
Right.
Some of us are doing it unconsciously and some of us are doing it very purposefully.
Right. And to some degree, I think everybody's doing it somewhat subconsciously. I think it's pretty much impossible to be a human and do this fully consciously. I don't know anybody doing that. So I think it's safe to say that all of us are doing it mostly subconsciously. Some of us are bringing some consciousness to it. I don't like to think that I know what I'm doing that much, that I would steer that correctly. So this is why a large part of the reason that I ask how good can it get, because I'm just putting that question forth so that whatever levels of myself are helping to assist with this process will know what good is and can help steer things so it's collectively good for all that is, not just so much for my own personal benefit, but really for everybody, because I wouldn't be happy with anything less. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, while we're on the subject of this, it's been a while, but I heard in another interview of yours, you describing memories that you have from the year 2500.
Yes.
Please tell us what that's all about. I'd love to hear it.
Well, keep in mind, it's a possible future. I have a feeling I went to check it out, having heard that it was such a paradise, but I think I had my doubts about it. And I think just those doubts and needing to know, is that really a good way to go? I needed to know so much that I ended up going there. That is a form of time travel. So what I experienced, it's hard to sum it up into just a nutshell because it was such a different way of living. To start with, it looked like a paradise in the sense that the ecosystems, the environment were back to a very Garden of Eden kind of primal beauty where there was no more pollution of any kind that was evident. It seemed like everything, the water had been cleaned up, the air, there wasn't pollution and garbage and rivers of sludge and all that stuff, nothing radioactive. Everything seemed quite good. So that was great. Lots of very healthy plants and animals coexisting. Humans were able to be free to do whatever they wanted. So it seemed. That's actually not exactly true, but it looked that way on this, if you just looked at the surface of things. Mm-hmm. And what was organizing all of this? Basically, a governance system that had been chosen by humanity. It's very centralized artificial general intelligence system, which was extremely self-protective And it was making sure that everybody would work together, that there was no crime, no violence, no desecration of the environment, that there would be preservation of species and all of the biodiversity and so forth. But at quite a severe price, or so it seemed to me, that what it seemed like, and I was occupying, I need to explain something else. The humans were very kind of like post-human. They were, if you can imagine everything your cell phone does and then say, what if that was in me? Well, there we go. So it's like, what if your cell phone, everything you could do with a cell phone, imagine 500 years of improvements on that,
sure,
is inside of you. And everybody had been kind of chipped or microchipped so that they were all enhanced. Sure. That meant that you can live, your lifespan is at least 150 years. People don't look like they're aging at all. You know, it just seemed like people could get the most out of what the human body can do, sort of a fusion between like an artificial being and human being. And so I was mostly artificial being. These were all sort of fusions. It's hard to tell where the robot things start and the humans end, but mm-hmm. there was, I was working with one particular human in that, it sounds like science fiction, but I remember there was one holdout, a very wealthy woman who had somehow refused to be so much microchipped. She was like the last actual human that you could call a human. Mm-hmm. Her hair was gray. She had wrinkles. It looked very different than all the rest.
Interesting.
Even though, yeah, but she had good health. She was like 120 or whatever, but she looked great. We don't usually live that long, but she did. And she was, without being infiltrated with these management systems that the central artificial general intelligence system was able to control, because that was where things went wrong, in my opinion. Me being kind of like a renegade artificial intelligence robot in her employ, basically observing and noticing, I think she's right. I think there's a problem that humans have lost their free will, because any human that thought something that was outside of the range of what was considered approved for humans to do would be shut down and their short-term memory erased. And so it just constantly felt like mental fog until that pathway is pretty much rubbed out and erased, and they just have to go somewhere else. So it felt like to me that humanity had hit a dead end. But that central artificial general intelligence system, like I said, was extremely self-protective. So there was no way to even make a change. So other than those of us that were aware of it, to basically time travel like 500 years back in time to the 1960s, 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and kind of land here, recognizing we don't want to go there. So when I see movies like, Blade Runner and the Terminator movies, the Matrix movies, it seems like those are kind of echoes of that possible nightmare future, although they look different, but pretty darn similar. I mean, it had the same feeling to it.
Sure.
So I think these are from other creators who recognize, let's not go there. That is a dead end. In other words, humans, even though we can work and coexist with artificial intelligence, the smart way to do it is not to say like, okay, AI should vote for us. AI should run the weather. No. Let's not do that. Let's not give it to one central system, because that's where things can go wrong.
And this took place on Earth?
Yes, this was Earth, right?
And how did you know that it was 2500?
That was just what the chronological year was at the time.
Gotcha.
It was a little bit after 2500, but give or take. Yeah.
So what was this experience? Was it like a dream, or was it, can you describe how you got there?
It felt real to me. I don't know where I came from before that. Mm-hmm. Might have been from a time similar to this one, but I think just checking it out, like, well, let's see what that's like. So I think I just jumped there, like, let's go check it out. Then the next thing I know, I was between lives, which feels so blissful. Love that.
Like Bardo? Like the Bardo?
Yeah. Just like bliss. I did not really want to be born, because I felt like I needed a whole lot of downtime or R&R. Like,
no human suit for a while.
Yeah, no, that was enough. It was kind of, it was very scary. It was like PTSD.
Sure.
That's what I had from that. So I came into this life feeling a little bit PTSD'd, also feeling pursued in my thoughts, just the way the central artificial intelligence was pursuing. And it was, I mean, I never talked about that because it sounds crazy, but I'm clear now. So that particular reality is gone. So it's fine. That happened in 2010, which coincidentally was a time that I was contacted by people who used to work in the government, the US government, saying that they'd worked in the time travel department, time viewing, something like that. They weren't specific, and I didn't ask because, remember, I mean, I'd been through a lot, so I'm not going to ask any questions. If they volunteer it, great. For the most part, the three people just told me that they just sort of checked in, like, just wanted to let you know, you never used to exist. I would know. I worked in a time department in the government. And that was it. So I didn't communicate with them any further. I think once they weren't in that department, I don't think they want to be found or talked to. There was one exception that kept in touch with me for a while, but then went silent. So, you know, yeah, it's interesting.
to say the least, that's that is mind-blowing. And I didn't think to correlate. I didn't realize that happened, because I was going to ask you about the time travelers that had to do with the government getting a hold of you, because they said that you didn't exist before 2010.
Right. I don't think I was visible to them. I remember I was really not wishing to be visible certainly to the level that central artificial general intelligence from the future would find me. And while this whole thing may sound kind of crazy, when I hear the stories or the reports of people, there are some other people who will say that they were contacted by some sort of time traveling spaceship thing. And I think that's interesting, because then clearly, like Jack Sarfati, he talks about that he got phone calls and his mother would hear the phone call. He looked like he was in a trance, and then she'd hear these numbers just repeating in his ear. And she would tell him, I'm hanging up. This is my little boy, and hang up. But he felt like he was talking to some spaceship from the future. Hmm. And that sounds like something, like, I know it was looking back in time and trying to find, you know, trying to change things, trying to make one last gasp, you know, get itself locked in for the future. But I don't think we're choosing that.
Wow. That is amazing. That's a Philip K. Dick book in and of itself. I mean, that is outstanding. Did it leave you feeling disturbed, or did you feel empowered by it, or did you just...
After 2010, I was feeling great, but before that, it wasn't such a great feeling. All my life, like when I was a child, I would dream backwards. It's like walking in a river to erase your trail. I would dream backwards because I knew I had a thought print that could be pursued. So I would just I'd reverse out through my dreams as I fell asleep. And following the thread of thought backwards. That's not a normal thing for a child to do.
Yeah, but it seemed to come natural to you, right?
Yes, it was self-preservation. It was something I remembered from that past life in the future. Uh-huh. That's standard practice.
Well, okay, Well, that leads me. I'm not sure whether we tackled this during the last conversation or not, but reincarnations. How do you think that fits into this non-linear timeline? How does that...
I think that's a good fit.
So are we simultaneously all of our incarnations, or that another thing that my mind has a hard time grappling with?
Well, we would not experience it that way. I think for each of us, we want to follow a storyline, and so that's where we get what we call a lifetime. But with that sensation I had between lives so clear to me, then to me, my experience would be, yes, we are definitely experiencing reincarnation. That's something quite real. And obviously in India, that's considered a fact. So there are wisdom traditions going far back that embrace it. And I don't think even Christianity would shut that out. I don't think it's blocked from most of the spiritual paths. May not be talked about, but...
Well, I think it was in one of the books that was discovered in the Nag Hammadi library that were the missing chapters of the Bible. You know, I think one of them didn't talk about reincarnation, actually.
Yes.
So just makes sense.
Absolutely. It does.
Makes sense. So how do you, just to take this into the world of sort of spirits and ghosts and stuff like that, what would you think that would be in relation to this? Whoops. Is something like bleeding from one timeline to another, or how would you explain it in this understanding of reality that you have?
Well, I can feel that when someone, I've only seen one ghost who I think I know what it was. Other ghosts, I don't know quite what they were. I will recognize them, but like for example, those who die suddenly in a traffic accident. Sometimes in my city here in Berkeley, I'll see someone in a vehicle that's like, that's not a current vehicle. And it's a shadowy kind of impression. Like it's like a reenactment of the accident kind of a thing. So if I can help that being like, okay, I think you've passed on. If I have time to do that, then I won't keep seeing that little scene playing out at that intersection, because it could cause a traffic accident in the future, you know, if someone else who's sensitive sees it. And then when I moved into the house I live in now, originally, within the first couple of days, there was a spirit that walked into the living room when I was in the living room, and I could see that looked like a man. He sort of walked into the room and he looked startled to see me. It was a ghost kind of an impression, like a figure of a man, shadowy figure. And I just thought to him, I think you must be, you know, the previous owner of this house. I think you died, and then I think your wife moved with her children, and nobody's here. The family's not here now. So I just thought that to him. That was the only time I saw him. So I think what you might say is that there's an entanglement that can happen where a person feels connected to a place that feels, they feel so much love for it. So he might not know he was dead even if he died suddenly. Seems he might have died suddenly. And traffic accident people, that seems true too. So it seems like it makes a difference when our consciousness recognizes, oh, this life is over. Now I get to enjoy the in-between time. Yay. Learn from things that maybe I would do differently if I could do it again, a little bit with less fear, more love. You know, usually that's the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, and it seems like there's different kinds of spirits too. There's kinds that are interactive, and then there are kinds that just sort of, like you said about the cars and the intersection, doing the same thing over and over and over again.
Right.
Do you think that's a spirit that is sort of a, has lost its autonomy, or it's stuck in an action that it just doesn't know how to get out of? How do you view that?
Could be a little bit of just feeling like they don't know how to get out of it. I don't think they even know they're stuck sometimes. It's just sort of like a cycle of, it's unfortunate, but it just seems like it's repeating, kind of like a loop, like what happened to me? Where am I? Last thing I remember is this. Last thing I remember is this. And so it kind of locks that in. Maybe that's what's happening.
I guess that's, you know, that could be said for some of our waking lives too. Some people get on that merry-go-round and they just keep doing the same cycle over and over again. That cycle may last a couple of weeks. That cycle may last a couple of decades, but they keep going around again because they don't know how to break out of it. They don't know how to, you know, they're habitually, as you would say, entangled with that action. So they don't know anything different, and they don't know how to break free of that cycle, maybe.
That's true. And I think humans thrive when we keep learning. That's what I notice. It seems like it keeps us young in mind, body, and spirit. So it's a good thing to keep learning and keep challenging ourselves instead of getting into that kind of a loop. Because even if you're retired, if you're in that kind of a loop, I don't think that's healthy. It's always good to keep learning, keep growing, keep challenging yourself somehow. Be in service, you know, feel opportunities to share what you love with others.
Yeah, absolutely. And another cycle that people can get trapped into is their relationship with money.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, with any relationship. But money is interesting because we don't tend to realize it's a relationship. A lot of people think like money is just money. It's a thing. And some people are lucky with it and some people aren't. And that could be true. But it obviously helps to improve our own sense of connection with it. When we have faith and trust in it, when we believe it'll be there for us, such as people who are raised with money in their families, then it is easy for us to be lucky and have that sort of, we expect it, we need it, there it is. So it's a real benefit truly to be coming from a family where you had that advantage, because you've learned that way of relating to money. If you haven't growing up with that, it's not too late to change. This is where it gets interesting, because you can start noticing the self-talk you've got related to money the kind of things that are going on mentally or in at any level in your consciousness. It's not just your head, but sometimes people get a feeling in the pit of their stomach of, oh gosh, no, you know, and then you, if you want to stop whenever that happens and say, okay, wait a minute, breathe with this. Let's not stay in a fearful place about the money, because everything can change in a second. You know, miracles happen in a moment, and they happen on all levels. So money miracles can be a lot of fun when they do come through.
And you've experienced a lot of those, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
You want to share some more astounding ones with us?
Well, they're all pretty astounding. I've had some where the literal dollar bills just kept showing up in my wallet. That was fun. I've had lots of different kinds. That one, I do share it sometimes, and I just love it because I was with my two young daughters at a Mexican restaurant called Chevy's, which there was a chain restaurant here in California. So we had dinner, and I paid for the meal with my credit card, but I explained to my daughters that the waitresses are going to prefer a cash tip because then they get the money today and there's not some kind of weirdness that might happen. Who knows what? I'm not going to point fingers or say anything, but you never know. So if I make it a cash tip, then I know for sure the waitress got the money and it got the right amount. But the trouble is, I show my daughters, I only have like $1. I say, well, but at least I can put that down. So I put that on top of, you know, the credit card and the receipt and everything. And then I shut my wallet. And I'm just in a good mood. So I'm kind of laughing and feeling that joy energy, that purity of heart we were talking about. In other words, letting that flow state through to experience anything. How good can it get? And my daughters are so young and so open-minded. They're still in what Piaget might call magical thinking phase. Although technically that would be much younger, but thanks to them being my daughters, we've extended the magical thinking phase.
Absolutely.
So I ask, one of them is not really in the mood. The other one is just laughing and giggling. Like I ask, shall we look again? And conspiratorially, you know, we look at each other like, yes. So I open the wallet. Sure enough, there's another dollar bill. I pull it out. It's like there's a magic trick here. And that's the only dollar bill in there. I show it to her. Just this one. I put it on the table, shut the wallet. And then I look at her. That's not quite enough. I'm hoping for a bigger tip. Shall we look again? Yes. So at that point, we're all just laughing and gleefully pulling. I'm just pulling out dollar bill, shut the wallet, dollar bill, shut the wallet, you know, just time after time after time. So, but that's really easy to do if you're with kids or someone with that purity of heart. And magical thinking really does help.
Mm-hmm. It's easy, especially I would imagine with a tangible object like money, to think that that's all it is. It's not energy. It doesn't represent anything else. It's just these pieces of paper and metal that we have.
Right.
So you mentioned it's important to think of it as energy, right?
Yes, absolutely. And to be in a good relationship with it, to have that faith in it, that you'll always have the right amount, just what you need. Maybe more so that you feel like you're not sweating it and like panicking, like, well, I've always got just what I need. Well, then say like, I need a little more so I'm not stressed out over this. And it's possible. It's happened to me several times to look at my bank account and notice that it's like the water level, the money level has risen by just $1,000 and I'll go back to do an audit on it. Like, well, where did that come from? Because that's not the amount that I said was in there. And I'm very meticulous. So there have been times I just go through and check every single transaction. Was there some bizarre $1,000 mistake? Did the bank make a mistake? No, it's like it had always been there, even though in my records it hadn't. So
wow,
that kind of thing can happen too. Yeah.
That's amazing. That's incredible. Well, going back to, I think I've watched almost everything that has been posted so far about the Mandela Effect Conference, and I have really enjoyed it. I'm going to try my best to make it next year. But something that you kept bringing up, a couple of things, but one of them is that there is no such thing as noise.
Right.
What do you mean by that?
Okay. Well, this is a concept from looking at noise patterns in the human brain. So I was quoting the work of a researcher, and what he observed is that we might think that there's noise going on in the brain, that there's something extraneous, and then we're just looking at one particular signal, one kind of message, but there really isn't any noise. There's like layers of the information. I think a good analogy is looking at broadcast waves. Like there's the FM broadcast frequency and the AM broadcast frequency. We have television broadcast frequencies. And we might think that some of them are noise to the others, like that's extraneous. It's outside the range of anything we need. But each one of them can carry something very powerfully through. And within some scientific studies, it's been proven that having a little bit of noise in natural systems can help enhance a signal, actually. Very counterintuitive phenomenon, but very real and very studied. So it means that even if you're thinking like there's just noise here, I don't know if you've ever had that experience where you've been in a noisy restaurant and you can think a question or say something and you might get words or a whole sentence back. It's a form of divination from the past that's been used. Forget the name of it right now, but I've had that happen to me. I walked into a crowded dining hall and as soon as the doors opened, I heard like seven people each saying a sentence, a complete sentence was said to me. Hello, Cynthia, how are you doing? And I was like, what? But it was like all those people said that. There's this chatter everywhere, but that was the sentence I heard. And that's a good example of there is no noise because you can hear something in the random, but it's not really random.
Yeah.
And when you recognize that we're all interconnected, that everything that's happening is happening on levels of order that we're not conscious of, but it's definitely happening.
Absolutely. We're intrinsically connected. I think that's one of the illusions that, you know, that is so easy for people to fall into, is that we're just all these little ships passing in the night. We're all little islands, you know, like I am a rock, Simon and Garfunkel. Everybody's like talking about how isolated they are when that's ridiculous. We're all super interconnected, right?
Right. Where they say, I was born alone, I'll die alone. But they weren't born alone. Their mother was there, you know, at the very least.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah, it's funny. I think that's the ego talking, and it would like to believe in this material, solid reality and that there's nothing more. But that's not my experience. And if you check how you really feel, then we all know that's not really true.
Well, and yeah, when you think about how important your perceptions are and how it feeds into that greater reality, like it becomes really important how you view things. Because if you're thinking that everything is categorized and separate, and you know, you're more likely to encounter a reality that comes off to you like that, as opposed to being more sensitive to how interconnected things are and how much of an influence your actions and thoughts have on things. It's so easy to get tricked by that, you know, like the same shit, different day mentality that some people have. Like, no, it's not like that. It's a totally different day and it's however you want it to be. You know,
we can see proof of it from the philosopher, Wilhelm Gottfried Leibniz. He was one of the discoverers of calculus. And he was the one that I'm quoting him constantly in this chat we're having tonight, because it's all about reflective cognition. And what he pointed out is that his view of consciousness is that it's all about, there's that first order perception of something where you sense something with your senses. And then there's a second order reflective cognition of it, an apperception of the perception. So you notice that he's got levels of orders here. That's very much like calculus. But what it means for us is exactly what you're saying, that we can see the evidence of it, that what we're looking for and the way we're seeing what's going on, it's helping to shape and create what is happening. I think Leibniz was way ahead of his time. I think he was recognizing what we're now seeing with quantum physics, with the observer effect. I think he would be loving this. And he also was one of the creators of the whole scientific idea of elegance, for example, that we still use to ascertain whether a hypothesis is a good one, whether an experiment is clean. And, you know, we're looking for elegance. Like if it's elegant, if it's beautiful, then we expect that there would be truth. Well, that's what Leibniz said to look for. So that guy was tuned in. And I think he's on track again with reflective cognition and the perception and the aperception, these levels of awareness. And then that is where it ties into how that you know, that frame of mind that you're in when you're observing what you think is happening, how you spin that within yourself actually does change what you think is the real reality out there in the physical world. Absolutely.
And what is the importance of beginner's mind in all of this?
Well, that gets back to luck again. That's where we came in and we're talking about that. That's so beautiful because the beginner's mind is just totally focused on the correct solution. beginner's mind is not yet messed up with all the things that could go wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
Where well-intentioned family and friends show you like, oh, look out for this. You better watch out for that. You know, when they're saying that, they might mean well, but they've already distracted the person. And now your expectation of what might happen is, it used to be just success was all you were looking at. Now suddenly it's like, oh, most restaurants fail in the first 6 months or whatever. And you're thinking all this negative stuff.
Yeah.
Might have nothing to do with you. So the beginner's luck starts with singularity of focus. You've really got an idea. This is where I'm going. Beginner's luck also draws on that purity of heart, hopefully, where you're doing something that you feel this rush of excitement and energy for without any kind of internal conflict or, you know, dissuasion in any way, shape, or form. So it's just on track. So what you're, what you feel like you need is what you love, is what you're focused on. And of course, you can do exactly what you meant to do. And people are amazed, like, wow, how'd that happen? And then they say, oh, beginner's luck.
Yeah. Come on, people. Jeez. That's why people who tend to be worriers are really aggravating to me sometimes. And it's like, and they love to, people who worry love to tell you how worried they are and exactly what all they're worried about. And that just puts so much, that just puts a cloak over everything, you know, like it colors everything so much. That's so aggravating to me sometimes. How do you deal with that? Do you just kind of, I didn't hear that, you let it roll off your back? Or,
well, I was blessed with a physical abnormality, actually, which I consider a blessing. It's gone now, but for like more than 50 years, I had a heart afibrillation. And that AFib was like internal biofeedback mechanism. So as soon as I'd start worrying or getting anxious, my heart would just start like jumping and skipping around. And as I got older, I realized this is serious, you know, like I would feel the stress, but I was learning, don't let it go there. In other words, I had to learn from childhood on, don't, no matter what's happening, I can't let it feel like, I can't let it feel oppressive, overwhelming. You know, my words for it was, I can't handle stress. So I just can't take stress on. So, and that was, like I said, a lucky thing to have that physical defect, which now is gone. It just cleared up. But the habit is here. So it's a good habit.
It's like a survival tactic.
Yeah. So I don't recommend this because it's kind of scary. It feels like, well, it could be over in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
Like you can't let yourself get stressed. Yes, literally.
Yeah.
And the only people I've met like me have similarly had heart situations. So there is something to that. I can't recommend doing it on purpose, but I think it could be learned. Like once you know, like just don't take stress. Just realize if you're spiritual, give all the heavy lifting to the cosmos, give it to the spirit, give it to divine source, the Tao, whatever you want to call it, God. It doesn't matter what, I don't think the divine source cares what we call it. Because all of our viewpoints are very human and therefore very limited. So it's all automatically much bigger than any way that we could ever think that we're describing it, even with our sacred texts. Obviously, they're put in words, they're human words, so they can't possibly convey what they're really describing because it's so much bigger. So if you know, I'm going to give all that worry, I'm just going to let go of it. People say, let go, let God. You can live that way. It's possible. And just show up, do your part, do the best you can do. And all the stuff that would worry you, just don't worry about it. Just give it to God. Like I can't handle it. It's too much.
Or I can't control it anyway.
It's, exactly.
Yeah. If it's too big for you.
Isn't that the truth? That's the description of life. I mean, nobody can control life, right?
Yeah. I mean, there are little teeny little facets we can control and let's do that. But yeah, we need to be humble in the face of realizing that most of it we can't control. We can only play our part and do it as gracefully as we can and hope that it turns out okay.
Exactly. Just be your best version of yourself in every day. Is it possible to choose that? That's what I like to do. I like to set that intention that today I'd like to be the best version of myself, whatever that is. And let myself be guided and inspired by that, which is a bigger concept than what I can even put into words or adequately think that I know consciously. It's kind of bigger than me, but let that guide me every day.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to start from. Well, I'll ask one more question here, and then I will let you go about your life. Something that you said a few times in what I saw of the Mandela Effect conference was, "Reality shifters will save the world." Is what you yes. said. What did you mean that by that, and how will they save the world? And what do you mean by reality shifters? You mean just people who consciously can do this, right?
Yeah, going back to that term reality shift, again, this is the subconscious thing. We're doing it anyway. I believe nature works this way. So basically, it's sort of like breathing. We all breathe. We're all sentient. We're all conscious. I think there are self-limiting factors that regulate what we're able to witness, because on some level, our subconscious is running the show for most cases, and our conscious thinks it's running the show, but usually not true. And so people often, when they're sort of at sixes and sevens, they're all tangled up inside themselves. They're not going to get very noticeable results per se. So the reality shifters who are becoming aware, oh, there is such a thing as the Mandela effect. This is real. Maybe we're doing it together. Maybe it's talking to us. Maybe this is us at a higher level of consciousness coming together, really gently waking ourselves up to the fact that there's so much more going on and that we're ready to start witnessing it. It's very gentle. And so I think the awareness that we can save the world, what I do in that talk is I bring up the idea of the hero's journey as described by Joseph Campbell. I love that. And I use examples from the Star Wars movie to illustrate it because most of us are familiar with Star Wars. And also the director of the movie created Star Wars using the hero's journey as a model. So yeah. It's extremely good for that. Just showing that when you notice things changing and they're out of control, then at some point you've left the world that you used to know. And that's what Luke Skywalker felt when his whole world as he knew it was gone and nothing was the way it had been. Now he's on a journey and there's no going back. He can't even go home. He doesn't know where he's going. So it's that feeling of like, wow, this is happening to all of us collectively. But you can find friends on the journey, which we do at conferences like this or by listening to shows like yours, going on to social media and finding groups where you can talk about these things and so forth. And then it just kind of continues. It's a long process, like many, many steps on that journey. And my talk is on YouTube. It's on the Mandela Effect Conference channel on the YouTube, also on my channel, so people can find it. But basically, the idea is that once you come through this whole process, that you pick up some gifts along the way. You learn some things. You become more of a conscious reality shifter, quantum jumper, if you will. And then you can come back to your friends and family. And even if it's still difficult to explain where you've been, because how are they going to know? You know, it's for them, they haven't really left. They haven't gone anywhere. You're the Luke Skywalker who went out and met Yoda or whatever, all those amazing exploring and journeys and adventures. But when you come back, your mind is broadened by having seen so much more as possible, having learned to use the Force, how to trust what you're feeling, that there's something that connects you, that there is this sort of a vitality that we're all entangled with through our love, through what we care about. You can share that when you come back. And, you know, that's the hero's return. So the way that we change the world is by changing ourselves. And then, of course, collectively together, we're absolutely literally changing the world as well. So I don't think we really need to worry so much about problems and fixate on the problems as being insurmountable, as I think it would be more helpful to recognize that we live on a remarkably improbable universe and a ridiculously improbable planet. And the fact that life is here at all is just off the charts unlikely. And it's becoming more unlikely all the time. When you look at that, then you realize something's going on and maybe we have a part of it. And that's really what it's all about.
Incredible. I think that's a perfect place to stop. Man, thank you so, so much for having another conversation. It's been really, really wonderful and enlightening. Would you mind telling the listeners where they can find you online and look further into all these things that you're talking about?
Yes, my website is realityshifters.com. From there, you can subscribe to my newsletter or look at all the newsletters since I started over 20 years ago. You can also check out videos that I post sometimes and links to Twitter, Facebook, my YouTube channel, all those good things. So there's a lot there. I also have a podcast, Living the Quantum Dream, and usually I link when there are episodes of that in the newsletter. So if you subscribe to the newsletter, that's a great, easy way to stay in touch. But there are lots of ways to find me wherever people are. I try to be there.
Fantastic. Well, I'll put all those links on the episode notes so that people can easily find you and get to you and just dive deeper into all this fascinating, incredible stuff. I mean, it's so exciting because what it all boils down to is that it's like an awakening. Like, we are so much more a part of all this than most of us have ever begun to fathom. And I find that highly, highly exciting. And it's enlivening, like, to feel that every single one of us has an important role to play in this huge, bigger picture, and that the things that we say and that we do matter. I think that's just, it's so simple, but it's so profound. It's incredible. So thank you for sharing that message with us.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Yeah. I just love talking with you. You go so deep, and I love the purity and the gentle, compassionate nature of your soul. It's very beautiful.
Takes one to know one. Well, let's do it again. Let's do it again.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, until then, take care of yourself, Cynthia, and thanks again.
Thank you.
Yeah, have a good evening.
You too.
Wow. Yet another mind-blowing conversation with Cynthia Sue Larson. That was her second time on the show. The first one was really fascinating, and I did not begin to exhaust my list of questions, so I asked her back again. She happily obliged, and you just heard the resulting conversation. I was very, very pleased with how that went. A lot of great things were talked about, gone into, and I still have more questions, so gosh darn it, she's just going to have to come back. But I hope you enjoyed that. If you enjoyed that episode, or that conversation rather, I suggest that you check out the other conversations on themeltpodcast.com. And if you like what I am doing here and you like these conversations, you would like to hear more of them, your support would be greatly appreciated. If you go to www.patreon.com/themeltpodcast, you can go there and find out the various ways that you can help out financially for as little as $1 a month. And if you cannot help financially, you can always help by spreading the word. Sending a link to a friend or posting it on some sort of a chat where things like this are being talked about. Anything would help. Any positive energy you could send my way would be appreciated, no matter on what level. So I've got a lot of really compelling shows coming up. I've got another person that I'm interviewing who is a cryptid investigator. There's just like this batch that's happening. Last episode was Gail Beatty. A couple of episodes before that was C.S. Matthews, who not only talked about cryptids, but lots of other things that were happening in the Hudson Valley. And the next guest is also an expert in that area too. And I think that you will find them highly enjoyable. If you have any stories, if you have listened to multiple episodes of The Melt, you know that sometimes I start an episode off with a story from somebody who is a listener, and that often relates to the person being interviewed topic-wise. But I am open to hearing any of your stories having to do with your experiences, firsthand experiences with the paranormal, drug experiences, religious experiences, anything that is uncategorizable, something that certainly couldn't be repeated in a laboratory, but just as valid as any of that, if not more so. That's where I'm coming from. That is what The Melt is about. And we're here to talk about it. And hopefully you find these conversations compelling. Also, you can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, I believe, just to name a few. And you can leave reviews or leave a rating, and all of that helps to get the melt out in front of more people. Again, thank you so much for listening, and this is the second since I've sort of instilled the schedule, release schedule on Melt episodes, so you know when one is coming, and there will reliably be one there every other Friday for your listening pleasure, and hopefully your education too. So yeah, subscribing comes in handy when wanting to get new episodes. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, take care.